From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the state Senate passes the Detroit aid package.
It was a lot like, you know, after the end of an all-star concert and all the musicians at the end come back out on stage holding hands.
Plus, 25 years after Tiananmen Square, a Michigan man remembers talking with those young protesters.
And I remember thinking, and with great sadness, seeing that student's face when he asked me to describe democracy and describe freedom. I wondered at that time on June 4th whether he was ever going to have his question answered.
And Grand Rapids wrestles with the question of whether to control panhandling.
Instead of turning to criminalizing poverty, we would really turn the conversation to how do we address the root causes of poverty.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside.
This is an opportunity to send the message, it's Detroit, Michigan, and Detroit, Michigan is on the comeback path.
Legislation to give a nearly $200 million state dollars to Detroit's bankruptcy settlement is now on its way to Governor Rick Snyder's desk. That's after the state Senate approved the measures yesterday. So how'd we get here, and where do we go next? I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour on Stateside, it was 25 years ago this day when the Chinese army turned on student protesters in Tiananmen Square. We'll speak with a Michigan man who was in Beijing leading up to that day. But first, Herbert Hoover was president when a law was passed in Michigan to make panhandling a criminal misdemeanor. That 1929 law stood until last August, and that's when the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the law, saying it trampled on the rights of free speech. Police in Grand Rapids had made pretty vigorous use of that now overturned law, arresting hundreds for panhandling over the years. With the state law overturned, Grand Rapids and other cities are trying to figure out just how to keep a lid on aggressive panhandling, yet respecting the constitutional right to free speech. Last night, the Grand Rapids City Commission had a meeting on proposed changes to local ordinances. Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter Lindsay Smith joins us. What happened last night, Lindsay?
The City Commission was set to vote on these local laws that would deal with basically time, manner, and place restrictions is how they frame this, that this is pretty common for free speech laws that, yes, you have a right to free speech, but the Supreme Court has recognized that there can be limits for certain reasons to that free speech. So they're trying to figure out when, where that would be acceptable or not. One of the main things that commissioners have focused on and that there seems to be some agreement about is panhandling right next to streets. So like you see people when you get on and off the freeway or on certain street corners holding signs, mm-hmm. approaching vehicles. People have gotten hit. Their causes kind of can be caused some traffic problems. So there's some public safety issues that they have recognized there. They tried to vote on that amendment separately, but there wasn't support for it. So there's been a lot of pushback on these proposed changes to the local laws. I feel like there's two separate issues here. There's the free speech issue, and then there's a lot of people who are concerned that we try to help people who are in need, right? So how do we do that? How do we make sure that we're not just pushing people who need help into the background? So what the commission decided was that they've got enough pushback at this point that they need to study this issue further. So next week, they'll sort of unveil the process for, it sounds like it'll be at least a couple of months to study the issue better, to come up with more clear laws on how designating when and where you could beg for money. And what exactly are the safety issues and concerns, and are they legitimate or not?
And I'm wondering if the proposed changes, for example, saying don't come out in traffic and don't come near roads, would they also then extend to kids holding signs and jumping up and down for a car wash, or maybe firefighters out with the Fill the Boot campaign? Would they be unilaterally applied?
Yeah, and that was part of the argument that came up. And the city's attorney has said that some of these cases, these people are breaking laws because of it's like a local sign ordinance that you're not supposed to be hold, you know, you have to get a permit to hold a certain kind of sign out. But it may be in a case where the city's not really enforcing it. So is there selective enforcement going on? So, yeah, this will be part of the I guarantee this will be part of this broader conversation as the city sort of works through, you know, what should be allowed and what shouldn't.
So at least for now, street corner panhandling is not illegal in Grand Rapids, yes?
It's definitely going on, and it's definitely not illegal.
Michigan Radio's West Michigan reporter, Lindsay Smith. Thanks so much, Lindsay.
Oh, no problem.
Keeping a close eye on all of this is the ACLU of Michigan. We're joined now by ACLU of Michigan attorney Miriam Aukerman. Miriam, what are your thoughts on what happened last night in Grand Rapids?
I was pleased to see that Grand Rapids is looking at this carefully and taking some time to study the issue, not rushing forward as it looked like it would be doing earlier. And so I'm really pleased that the commission is taking time. There are a lot of moral, legal, and financial issues that cities should look at in relation to panhandling ordinances, and Grand Rapids is taking time to do that.
And I know Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell last night talked about concerns that the ACLU might indeed sue Grand Rapids over any restrictions. So he called for a period of study to come up with local rules that basically don't get the city sued. I'm wondering, is that possible? And are there restrictions and modifications on panhandling that the ACLU would find did not trample on constitutional free speech rights?
Well, let me start by saying that after the Sixth Circuit decision, we did a review of panhandling ordinances across the state, and the state law was held unconstitutional, and many municipalities have local ordinances. We wrote to over 80 local municipalities asking them to repeal or revise the ordinances, and I'm happy to say that about 55 of them have either repealed, gotten rid of the ordinances they have, or have amended them, have changed them, or are reviewing them. And so many cities are actually doing the opposite of what Grand Rapids is doing and saying, in light of this decision, we want to protect free speech. We want to make sure that everybody who needs help can ask for help in our city. Unfortunately, Grand Rapids seems to want to move, or some people in Grand Rapids want to move in the opposite direction.
Well, Miriam, when you say some municipalities amended their rules, what kind of amendments are you talking about? What would that kind of rule look like?
A variety of ways in which cities have tried to restrict panhandling, and each of them presents different moral and legal challenges. The proposed Grand Rapids ordinance would, for example, make it illegal to panhandle 15 feet from it, any building with an ATM in it, 15 feet from a bus station, 15 feet from a taxi stand, lots and lots of different places.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the issues, there's a number of legal issues with those kinds of restrictions, because first of all, it's very hard to know where you can and cannot ask for help if, for example, who knows whether a building has an ATM in it. The other issue is how much of a city is then actually off limits. And one of the things that we've asked of Grand Rapids is if you're going to do something like this, you really need to map it, because if you are effectively doing what the court said you couldn't do, which is to ban panhandling throughout the city, then the court is going to have real concerns about that.
I know another angle of this was raised by Michigan's Attorney General when he was arguing in favor of the state law last year, and he argued the statute was justified because it prevented fraud. Is there a way to do that, to prevent fraud and not infringe on free speech, or does it come down to me as someone who's going to decide whether to hand that person a dollar bill or not?
I think Judge Yonker, in his decision, finding the state law unconstitutional, said it exactly right, which is that we already have laws against fraud. We have laws against interfering with traffic. We have laws against lots of the conduct that people are concerned about. And what government can do is enforce laws that target fraud, that target interfering with traffic, without trampling on free speech. The problem comes when the government targets speech rather than conduct, and that's what these ordinances do. What we need to be doing, whether it's fraud, whether it's traffic concerns, we need to be focusing on the conduct. So if someone is interfering with traffic, whether that's a panhandler, whether that's a fireman collecting in a boot, whether that's a kid jumping up and down trying to get you to come to their car wash on the side of the road, whether that's a person asking for directions. If the person is interfering with traffic, well, then we have laws against that. Mm. But what we shouldn't be doing is focusing on speech, because that's when we have constitutional problems.
Miriam, where do you see this debate winding up? I mean, we're focusing the spotlight on Grand Rapids. I'm sure similar conversations are happening in other cities. Where do you see this going?
These conversations are happening across the state in Michigan and across the country, and courts have been looking at these ordinances, many of them saying that these ordinances are unconstitutional and that we can't simply sweep poverty under the rug. We can't simply say that we don't want to see it, that we have to protect people's free speech rights. And so I think this is going to be a continuing conversation. It's a conversation that has very significant moral and legal implications, as well as financial implications. And one of the things that we certainly want cities to consider as they think about that is just what it costs to actually prosecute people for being poor. There was a study recently in Florida that showed that the cost of incarcerating just 37 chronically homeless people who are repeatedly committing these types of offenses was about $5 million over a 10-year period for just 37 people. And we found in Grand Rapids that the average person who was arrested for begging was spending 6 days in jail. So there's a tremendous financial cost, there's a moral cost, and I guess our hope really is that instead of turning to criminalizing poverty, we would really turn the conversation to how do we address the root causes of poverty? How do we provide the services that people need? A person who's homeless on the street costs taxpayers $31,000 a year, whereas providing supportive housing is going to cost about $10,000 a year. So aside from the legal and moral implications, there's also just the plain financial question of what is the best way to address poverty. And the best way is not to criminalize people for being poor or to criminalize people for needing help, but rather to provide that hand up to really real change, supportive housing, and the kinds of services people need to get back on their feet.
Miriam Aukerman is an attorney with the Michigan ACLU. Miriam, thanks for talking with us.
Good to be here.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 25 years ago this day, Tiananmen Square in central Beijing was the focus of pro-democracy demonstrations. Crowds of protesters, including students and factory workers, had been camped out in that square for weeks. But when the Chinese army made its decisive move, hundreds, perhaps even thousands of people were killed. Afterward, more were executed, and hundreds were given lengthy prison sentences. 25 years later, the vast majority have been released. Just one man is believed to still be in jail. Stateside's partner with the BBC, Celia Hatton, has been speaking to the handful of people who still remember Tiananmen's last prisoner.
For 6 weeks in the spring of 1989, protesters occupied Beijing's Tiananmen Square. They were demanding democratic reform. Using tanks and guns, it took just one day for soldiers to regain control of the square. We still don't know how many died. When the shooting stopped, the arrests began. 1,600 people received prison sentences. Just one is thought to remain behind bars. We know little about him beyond his name, Miao Dushun. A factory worker, Miao was caught up in the attempts to stop the Chinese military from killing civilians. He's thought to have thrown a basket at a burning tank, and for that, he was convicted of arson. We tracked down one of Miao Dushun's former cellmates, a soft-spoken man named Dong Shengkun, who was released from prison 7 years ago. He risked police detention in order to tell us his memories of Tiananmen's last prisoner.
He was a quiet person. He was often very depressed.
Miao was painfully thin, almost emaciated, Dong Shengkun explains.
We both received suspended death sentences. Because of that, we were supposed to have our feet in shackles. I was locked up, but he wasn't. He said the guards probably thought he was too thin to be able to wear foot chains. He wouldn't be able to walk under the weight.
Miao refused to write letters expressing regret for his participation in the Tiananmen protests. Many who knew Miao in prison believe that's the reason he has not been released.
The authorities treated him as if he was insane. I heard they moved him to Yanqing prison.
We decided to drive to the far reaches of Beijing to see Yanqing prison ourselves. A decades-old institution, it houses elderly and mentally ill prisoners.
After driving through the mountains for hours, we finally reached the prison where we believe Miao Dishun has been living for the past few years. Now, technically, we're still in Beijing, but it certainly feels as if the Chinese government has banished Miao Dishun to another world, far away from the politics of Tiananmen Square.
Beijing's Justice Bureau refused to confirm anything about Miao Dishun, but most people who knew him agree he's probably living behind the prison's high concrete walls. That group includes this man, Zhang Baoqun, another one of Miao's former Tiananmen cellmates. Inside a Beijing restaurant, he flips through a book of famous photographs from 1989. He's never seen anything like this before. He sighs in recognition at each page. Turning to photos of Tiananmen student organizers, Zhang complains the students received light punishments. That's compared to poor factory workers like Zhang and Miao Dishun, who joined the protests later on.
No one spoke up for ordinary people like us. The guys with good connections were protected by student associations. They received lesser sentences.
Some believe that Miao Dishun is already dead. Miao might have passed away years ago, and the prison authorities could be refusing to publicly acknowledge his death. However, if Miao is still alive, he's set to walk free in September 2018. At that point, he will have served almost 30 years in prison for throwing a basket at a burning tank.
Stateside's partner, the BBC's Celia Hatton. Tom Watkins was in China on his very first trip, and that time led up to the day when the People's Liberation Army turned on its people. Watkins has spent years campaigning for stronger economic, cultural, and social ties between the U.S. and China. Today, he's the president and CEO of the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority. Welcome back to Stateside, Tom.
It's always good to be with you. Thank you, Cindy.
Tell me what memories you have from being there 25 years ago.
Well, it was a lifelong interest of mine. A great fourth-grade teacher sparked my interest in China many, many years ago. And so in early May of 1989, I was traveling to China. We arrived in Shanghai as the incident was beginning to build up and the people were coming, the students were coming to the square. And I remember asking when I got off the plane about this incident and the students protesting, and people in Shanghai told me, well, it's not to worry. It's a small protest, maybe 50,000 people, which seemed pretty big to me. But mm-hmm. when you understand that China is 1.3 billion people, I guess a gathering of 50,000 isn't much. But as we traveled to China and Shanghai and Xi'an and Nanjing and ultimately ended up in Beijing, I would finish up my responsibilities and go down to Tiananmen Square and troll for people that spoke English who could tell me. And at that time, the early weeks of the build-up, it was like a big Boy Scout jamboree. It was happy. It was organized. People had food committees and security committees and lanes that were cleared so people could walk through. And almost inevitably, as I'd walk through, a huddle of Chinese students would form around me and ask me questions about America and democracy and freedom. And I'll ask about how, you know, at that time I was the state mental health director, and how a person in their 30s could be, in essence, the provincial health official. But the one that really struck me was when the students asked me, in halting English, to describe democracy, to describe freedom. And obviously, I've given it a lot of thought as somebody who grew up in Washington, D.C. during the Vietnam era and of what our freedom and what our democracy meant. But at that moment, while I recited the ability to choose where you live, whether you believed in a God or not, or what religion to believe in, how many children you would have, or whether you chose to live in the countryside or the city, which people were prohibited at that time from moving from the countryside in the city, I really felt quite inadequate to describe what we take for granted. It felt like trying to tell somebody that has never experienced freedom and democracy what it's like to wake up in the morning and start to breathe.
Mm. And make your own choices. It certainly speaks to how tightly controlled things are, that even at this point there's no real sense of how many people died when the army opened fire.
Yeah, there's a denial almost that it took place in the history of China, and very few young people will even know much about it. But some suggest a few hundred, and some suggest over 1,000. But you're absolutely right. There is no official number of people that lost their lives, as you aptly put, as the Chinese People's Liberation Army turned on the people.
And and we should also let people know that this wasn't just in Beijing. There were movements throughout China, correct?
That is correct. In fact, there was a major incident in Chengdu in Sichuan province in the western part of the country, as well as in Shanghai, Nanjing, and the like. But the capital of China is Beijing, and even today, everything going forward is going to intersect at the corner of Beijing and Washington D.C. because the relationship between our two countries are, in fact, in my view, the most important bilateral relationship in the world today. And so, working with and finding a way to engage the People's Republic of China going forward and their leaders is absolutely critical, not only to our respective countries, but in fact, all of humanity.
And I want to get into that more in a moment. I'm just curious, were you there actually on June 4th when bullets flew, or had you left by then?
No, I'd left. We had scheduled to be in China for 3 weeks, and I think it was May 19th or May 20th when we left China. But I remember on watching the events from here, and certainly a lot of people forget this, but Mr. Gorbachev was in China and about in the middle of May, and it was a true embarrassment to China that they had to, in essence, sneak the president of Russia in through the back door. And I think this precipitated a lot. So media around the world happened to be in China at that time, worldwide media, to cover that reform and that relationship rebuilding between China and the old USSR. So media was there. And so when I at home, I watched. And I remember thinking, and with great sadness, seeing that student's face, which is still etched in my mind, when he asked me to describe democracy and describe freedom. I wondered at that time on June 4th whether he was ever going to have his question answered in his own way, in his own country.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Tom Watkins, who's the president and CEO of the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority, and speaking to him really in the guise of someone who has traveled frequently to China, has spent years campaigning for stronger economic, cultural, and social ties between our country and China. And you say you think this is the most important relationship on the planet.
Absolutely. In fact, few people realize, but China may surpass the United States as early as this year as the world's largest economy, and that's going to come as a great shock to a lot of people. But if you look at a historical context, China has had the world's largest economy 18 out of the previous 20th century. It's one out of every five people on the planet are Chinese, fastest-growing economy, and what they've accomplished over the last 30, 35 years has been remarkable, as it is amazing. Literally hundreds of millions of people have risen out of abject poverty into the equivalent of the middle class. And there's historically been a trade-off between the Communist Party and the Chinese people, and that is simply that the people's lives will continue to prosper economically, and the Communist Party will continue its rule. And that promise over the last 30, 35 years certainly has proven to be true, as the lives of the average Chinese people have improved immensely. And yet the Chinese leaders going forward have massive problems of an aging society. They always would say that China must grow rich before it grows old, and they're not going to quite make that. The pollution problem in China is immense. The tension between some of the ethnic minorities, and there's over 55 distinct minority groups in China, and particularly between the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, and perhaps a little bit to a lesser extent to the Mongolian people, but there's tremendous tensions between those minority groups. So the Chinese leaders have some major issues to address moving forward.
And we have growing tensions between our two countries. We have the U.S. accusing the Chinese of hacking, of cyber espionage. And then there have been rising tensions as witnessed by these comments. This was just from a few days ago with Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel.
But in recent months, China has undertaken destabilizing unilateral actions asserting its claims in the South China Sea. The United States will not look the other way when fundamental principles of the international order are being challenged.
And then you had a Chinese official shot back saying Chuck Hagel's speech is filled with, quote, instigation, threats, and intimidation, that he's trying to stir up disputes. So all is definitely not sunny between our two nations.
No, it's not. And it's quite honestly, it shouldn't come to surprise to anyone. If you look back in history, any time a rising power, and certainly China is that, reclaiming its mandate from heaven and regaining its stature on a nationalistic way, a rising power conflicts with the existing power, the United States. And so we can anticipate that there is going to be some tensions. What we have to realize, though, is that we need China to be successful. Our relationship with China is absolutely critical going forward. And as I've indicated prior to this, is that it's not only important to the people of America and the people of China, but all of humanity, that we find ways to solve the problems between our two great nations, because the failure of either China or the United States for the world, quite honestly, is unthinkable.
And yet, as we talk about the pros of increasing our ties, one has to wonder what you talked about as the Chinese people become wealthier and more enlightened, isn't there an internal tension that is eventually going to blow between the regime keeping them suppressed and people with greater realization of what could be?
Well, I think that there's going to continually to be that. But when I watch the Chinese leader, they remind me of my grandmother with her old pressure cooker with that little jiggler
mm-hmm.
on the top.
I remember
it. Would be able to let off just enough steam in order to keep things from blowing. Mao Zedong once said that the smallest spark can start a raging forest fire. And as you look around the sparks that are around the world, China has been able to keep that spark from flaming into that raging forest fire that Mao talked about in the past. So they're constantly looking away. If you take a look at their economy, for instance, I mean, how could China switch from being a socialist communist country to, some would argue, are more capitalistic than we are here in the United States today. And Deng Xiaoping, who was a contemporary of Mao, who was a leader in 1989, mm-hmm. said at that time, when he was asked, how can China be opening up to the world? How can you be a communist socialist country and really be moving towards capitalism and open markets? And his response at the time was to quote an ancient Chinese saying, that I don't care if it's a white cat or a black cat, as long as the cat can catch the mice. And so the Chinese leaders have always found a way to bob and weave, to find a way to accommodate in order to maintain their control of the country since the founding of the People's Republic of China on October 1st in 1949.
Tom Watkins, longtime China observer, frequent visitor to China, currently president and CEO of the Detroit Wayne Mental Health Authority, as we look back on the world history that was made 25 years ago this very day in Tiananmen Square. Tom, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you today.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder says he will indeed sign the bills giving almost $200 million state dollars to Detroit's bankruptcy settlement. That's after the state Senate approved the package yesterday. Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Rick, we watched this package of nine bills bringing almost $200 million as part of the grand bargain. We saw it sail through the Senate yesterday. Fill us in. How did we get to that point?
Well, this was not a done deal in the Senate as recently as yesterday morning. You know, half a dozen, maybe seven Republicans were on board. And the game changer really seems to have been federal judge Gerald Rosen, who's sort of been the chief negotiator on the grand bargain, coming in and explaining the deal to lawmakers, how the numbers in the grand bargain came together, that they weren't just random. Now, most Republicans still voted against the main bills in the package, but Rosen seemed to give them enough comfort, or at least enough of them enough comfort, to put the package over the goal line. A key point was the possibility of a lawsuit filed by pensioners, and it forced the Senate, like it's about to confront the pensioners who are voting on the bargain. And the question is, in the words of Clint Eastwood, you know, how lucky do you feel?
Sure.
If this deal goes south, all of this winds up in court. And if it loses, the state could be on the hook for all those pension costs if courts rule that you know, the pension protections are in the state constitution. Mm. Now, on the other side, pensioners who might want to reject the deal have to ask themselves the same question. How lucky do I feel? Do I want to stake my future on what courts might decide in a battle over pension rights?
You know, Rick, we did hear last week and week before that or so that the Tea Party group, Americans for Prosperity, had said, ooh, we're going after lawmakers who support these bills. But it appears that message didn't seem to worry lawmakers enough to vote against them.
Well, I think that most of the Republicans who voted against it would have anyway. And most Republicans, 16 of them, did vote against the main bills. Mm-hmm. And that included the Republicans who would be most concerned about that, which is the ones who have primaries. But it didn't scare off the others. And on the Democratic side, well, State Senator Coleman Young of Detroit was the only Democrat to vote against all the bills, to the chagrin of his colleagues. And he says it's because the rules in the grand bargain, or at least the state's part in it, is basically just a state takeover of the city.
Hmm. One part of the legislation that the Senate didn't even take up, but that the House did, was that bill that would have prevented the Detroit Institute of Arts from being able to go back and get a millage renewal or a new millage in Wayne, Oakland, and McLean County. What happened there?
Well, look, this was DOA once it left the House and arrived in the Senate. It was necessary to pick up the votes of some Macomb County Republicans in the House, and it was just done after that. Hmm. However, you know, the fact that it wasn't part of the package does speak to the importance of the Senate passing a clean package. No amendments, no changes, so it didn't have to go back to the House, so all of that stuff didn't have to be renegotiated. And one of the big reasons that it moved so quickly, actually, was that the Senate recognized that this wasn't just the governor negotiating with the legislature, the city coming and negotiating with the legislature, mm-hmm. Republicans with Democrats, the House with the Senate. This was the state negotiating against the terms already set out in the grand bargain. Changes, even small ones, would have torpedoed the whole thing and sent the pension mess to be litigated.
So when Kevin Orr showed up in Lansing and also up there shaking hands on Mackinac saying, we have to do this and we have to do this fast, people clearly were listening.
Yeah, it appears so, that Kevin Orr made the case on Mackinac Island and he made the case again here in Lansing that for pensioners, if this deal falls apart, it is not mathematically possible for them to do financially better, that no matter how much money you might think the city has in assets, whether it's $2 billion, $3 billion, $4 billion, is the pensioners are going and they're getting thrown in with all the other creditors that are out there. Mm. And you know, without that protected status, and you're taking those city assets and basically spreading them out amongst $12 billion in liabilities.
Rick, take us to the moment after the bills were passed. What was the mood like among the lawmakers?
Well, after the bills were passed, everyone gathered in the governor's office in the state capitol. And Kevin Orr was there and Randy Richardville was there. Jace Bolger, the House Speaker, was there. You know, even Judge Rosen. It was a lot like, you know, after the end of an all-star concert and all the musicians at the end come back out on stage holding hands. You know, they take their bow.
Right.
For some reason, this detail did not get reported, but they all sang, I Shall Be Released.
Let's talk about these bills, Rick, in somewhat of a broader context. You know, legislation in Lansing doesn't happen in a vacuum, and there's talk that this vote could determine what happens with road funding. Explain that to us.
Well, count me among the skeptics. Some people are saying that this could be a template for bipartisan cooperation on other things, especially a bipartisan solution on road funding, because that will not happen without Republicans and Democrats coming together for it. There just aren't enough votes in any, you know, any of the caucuses to do it on their own.
Okay.
But Democrats are putting a lot on the table, that they're saying that if you want us to come across Republicans for your road funding bill, well, we want to see some working class tax relief, maybe the earned income tax credit. They're talking about the pension tax, which is just a non-starter with Republicans. Quite bluntly, they want to make sure that when the vote tallies go up, that there's roughly an equal number of Republicans to Democrats. Mm-hmm. Democrats don't want to be the ones to put most of the votes up for a Republican roads package and then have Republicans hang that on them in the November elections, you know, the tax and spenders.
Yes.
And also, you know, we should point out that you know, this is a big deal where Republicans are coming to Democrats and saying, we need you. We can't do this without you. This is the Democrats' last best chance to negotiate the terms of the rest of this legislative session, especially lame duck, you know, with an eye toward blocking Republican efforts to scrap prevailing wage laws and to shake up the electoral college system that has delivered Michigan to Democratic presidential candidates in election after election after election after election.
Rick, we know Governor Snyder is certainly going to sign this. He said he would.
He held up his pen and said he was ready.
That's it. Do we have any idea when that will happen?
He said the next day or two that obviously it's being, you know, proofread and you know, making sure that every, you know, dot on an I and cross on a T is where it should be. You know, it won't be today. You know, it could be tomorrow, but I would say probably Friday or early next week.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. As always, thanks so much, Rick.
As always, my pleasure, Cindy.
To Stephen Henderson now, editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press, which declared today, Lansing, take a bow. And Stephen, we just heard from our Rick Pluta, the governor is going to sign this nine-bill package, but it's just one part of the whole puzzle, right? This horse has not yet crossed the finish line?
Not quite, but, you know, this is the home stretch for sure, getting this legislation passed in Lansing is a huge piece of the puzzle. Really, the only thing left is the vote of the pensioners themselves, who have to, you know, in sufficient numbers support this so that the whole deal finally comes together. But the governor told me this morning, you know, for the first time, that, you know, it looks like this will all hang together and it'll happen. Which I think is an enormous relief for him, but also, you know, something of a big political victory.
Very much so. And I'm sure these pensioners have been keeping a very close eye on what was or wasn't going to happen in Lansing before deciding how they were going to vote. Are you hearing from them?
A little bit. I mean, I'm more hearing from their representatives who have been talking to me about the uncertainty that they face. You know, I think a lot of pensioners are still not wild about the idea of taking any cut at all, and they've got to do the calculus to sort of figure out that, yeah, that's the ideal, but the more likely resolution is some cut, and if you're going to take some cut, this is a reasonable cut to take, but, you know, each person has to decide that on their own, and so I'm hearing a lot from the leadership about what they're hearing from rank and file about how difficult that decision is and how much time people are taking to make it.
It has to be a hard decision for, you know, you're a retiree and you're looking at this big old, you know, document and you're supposed to plow through that and you have to think in terms of finances and then emotion.
Yes, that's right. That's a great way to put it. I mean, the financial part of it is not insignificant. I mean, these are not people, for the most part, who make a lot of money off these pensions. These aren't giant tensions that we hear sometimes about in the public sector, they're very meager. And even a small cut, which is what, you know, what this is gonna sting. It's gonna make a difference in their lives. But the emotional part is just as important, and the emotional part is tied up at least somewhat in the idea of a promise kept or broken. The city promised these people that they would get this money,
yeah.
And is now saying you can't have it. And I think there is a lot of justifiable anger about that. There's a lot of trepidation about what that means down the road. If this promise is broken, could others be? And they've got to sort through all of that. And I'm enormously sympathetic to these pensioners and how they vote. I think this has got to be one of the toughest choices they'll ever make in their lives.
Let's go back to this Senate vote that happened yesterday, Stephen, and give us your sense of what the Senate and the House coming together, what this means for the city and for Michigan going forward.
Well, I think you can look at some of the things that were said. You had senators, just like you did in the House last week, you had people from West Michigan standing up talking about how they stand with Detroit. I mean, I don't think you have to have been here long to note how unusual that is and almost unprecedented. This idea that the fortunes of Detroit are tied in with the fortunes of people, not just the whole state, but individually with people from other specific places in Michigan, that's all new. And we heard so much of that with the House debate, and then last week on Mackinac, and then again with the Senate debate this week. But you have to start, I think, believing that it's real and that these things that people are saying are sincere. And then I think you can allow yourself to hope that that carries forward, because there are going to be other things that we're going to need to work on together to get Detroit back to where we all think it should be.
Take off your newsman's hat for a moment, if you will, and talk to us as a lifelong Detroiter. When you realize that this Detroit aid package was passed by the Republican-controlled House and Senate, the effort was led by the Republican governor, as a Detroiter, how did you feel?
Yeah, well, I mean, I, again, it's a little through the looking glass, right? This is not the relationship we've had with Lansing, with outstate Republicans, not in my lifetime. I know that there are lots of Detroiters who are still very skeptical about this and believe that there is some angle to this that's not yet apparent, that, you know, benefits them and somehow will harm us. But you know, I think I've looked as closely at this stuff as anybody, and I don't see it. I mean, I think it is genuine, and it is remarkable that you have, and it's, you know, it's not everything. There's still lots of hurdles we're going to have to overcome. But it is a real effort to reach out that I don't remember seeing before as a Detroiter.
We're speaking with editorial page editor of the Detroit Free Press and lifelong Detroiter Stephen Henderson as we talk about the passage of the $195 million deal for Detroit by the state Senate, now on its way to being signed by Governor Snyder. And you referred to skeptics, and with that, I have to ask you about what we heard from Senator Coleman Young of Detroit yesterday. He explained to us why he was the only Democrat to vote no on all 9 bills in the package.
It simply won't do for the people of my city, my friends, my neighbors, my constituents, to be put under the thumb of another body handpicked by this administration to enact policies in the own best interests, not Detroit's.
Stephen, doesn't that do a disservice to the city? I mean, here we have Republican lawmakers saying we're going to help and often going against what some in their own party want. And here's Coleman Young going, we don't want your help. Keep your nose out of our business.
Yeah, well, that defines the relationship we've had with Lansing for a really long time. You know, what's ironic is that, you know, Senator Young is not even old enough to remember any of that stuff, right?
Right.
This is a guy parroting things he's heard from other people, and shame on him for doing that rather than living in the moment and being present for what's happening in Lansing, which is significant, that you know, he wouldn't know that the Republican legislature of 20 or 30 years ago would have been saying and doing something very different with regard to this than this legislature has done. And he's doing a disservice to them, but also to his constituents. He, the district he represents doesn't have lights for the most part, doesn't have, anyone to tear down hundreds of thousands of abandoned houses. Life is unlivable for the people who live in his district. And this package is a way to make it better. How you justify, sort of a defiant stand against help to do that is quite beyond me.
Stephen, in your opinion, now that this part of the grand bargain, this big piece is in place, how do you think this whole process was managed? And who gets credit for this? Is it Kevin Orr? Is it Judge Rosen? Is it Governor Snyder? Is it everybody?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest credit is probably going to go to Judge Rosen, who, may or may not have dreamed this up on his own, but certainly he was the first person to put it out in the public that he wanted to do it, and has shepherded it through all of the different phases. I mean, you had an enormous hurdle with the foundations themselves, right?
Yeah.
And going to them and saying, hey, we want you guys to put all this money in. That wasn't an easy sell. Then he had to get to the DIA and get them to put money in. And then he had to get to the state. And ultimately, he also had to get the unions to kick in. So he really has, I think, emerged. And he didn't do that alone, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he is the prime sort of leadership figure there. But then you also you've got the governor getting the legislature to do that. You have the heads of both houses in the legislature playing significant roles. There's a lot of credit to go around. And again, it's all toward an unprecedented end that I think, 20, 30 years from now, they will still be talking and writing about what was accomplished in this time for the city.
Stephen Henderson, Detroit Free Press editorial page editor. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Stephen. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And on our next stateside, Michigan's Green Party holds its convention.
We can see in Michigan that there is not much ecological wisdom or social justice or grassroots democracy in our daily lives.
A conversation with the chair of Michigan's Green Party. That's next time on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.